So once again, thank you for inviting me to have a conversation with you this evening. I hope it is a conversation. I'm very happy for us to talk as I go along. I'm very happy to have questions at the end. I'm also very happy if people have their own opinions and disagree with me. That would be fine. We can engage in a conversation, so that would be great. So feel free, if there's something that you want to ask about or add, do, from your own experience, please do. It's the best way to learn, isn't it? Any comments or thoughts about the meditation practice that you noticed, that you wanted to ask about? Please.
I'm wondering about the practice of Kamatana meditation.
Mm-hmm. Can you say something about that, what you know so far?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, can you say something about what you know so far?
Oh, no, I'm not sure about how to actually approach it, because I've been looking at it for a while, but I'm not sure.
So what have you been doing, just so I know where we're starting?
Kamatana meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Basically observing the whole body.
Okay, yeah. So okay. So this observation of the whole body is one of the very old and early meditations found in actually nearly all traditions, not just Buddhism. In Buddhism, this is known as kaya nupassana, kaya being the body or the form, but particularly the sensations of the body. So there's a number of ways of doing this, but the most common one is to tune in to either one sensation in the body or to scan the body and tune into the sensations through the whole body. So some of you will have heard of Esen Goenka, that Vipassana practice. This is the big place up in Blackheath and around the world. They do a body scan practice where they start from the head and move down through the body, and what they're doing is noticing sensations. And sensations here particularly are vibrations. So if you're scanning the body from head through to toe, or indeed from toe through to head, what you would be noticing particularly are vibrations in the body. Why would we notice vibrations in the body? Because they're said to be fairly fundamental to our experience. Sensation is how we know who we are. There's a couple of other ways, but it's a fundamental way. So why would we do this? Well, A, it's quite fundamental, and B, it reveals a few things. And one of the major things that's revealed, particularly if we're noticing vibration, we notice very viscerally, physically in ourselves, that there is change. So we're tuning into the natural process of change. But it becomes more and more microscopic, and it becomes more vibrational as well. When this begins to happen, usually the form of the body or the part of the body that you're particularly focused on may get a bit fuzzy. The outline and proprioception, which holds us in place and gives us our sense of where we are in space, may not be working quite as in the foreground. So this is a good thing in terms of meditation practice, but it can be a little anxiety provoking as well if we're not ready for it, because we feel like the body might be disappearing. And people sometimes, when their concentration is good, may well see the body actually breaking up. It's an actual perception. So I only say that to, if you are doing the practice and moving into it more intensively, just to know these things so you don't get anxious. This is actually a very good sign of very good practice, but it can be disturbing if you're not ready for it as well. So that's one way of doing this body scanning practice, or looking at bodily vibrations. There are other ways as well. If you're tired, for example, it can be useful to become a bit more cognitive about the practice of looking at the body. So what we can do when we're sitting is, as we're putting our attention through the body, we can actually visualise in our mind the shape of the body sitting upright. So it takes a bit more cognitive effort to do that. It gives us more to do, so we're less likely to fall asleep, more likely to stay awake. We can even just notice one, two, or three sitting and touching sensations. There's quite a lot going on. So, you know, we notice we're thinking about or visualising the shape of the body through the touch points, and then we notice one, two, or three touch points that are very obvious, and we put our attention on each of those, noticing the quality of those bodily touch points. This is actually very good practice for concentration, and very good if you're tired too. It's quite stimulating in a sort of a way. If we just try and go to minute sensations to start with, we drop off them all the time. You know, we need to climb the mountain first. We can't get to the peak straight away. And if you're tired and you go too fine on sensations, you'll just lose it and you'll fall into a sort of a sleep. So sometimes if you're tired, you can choose a meditation that's more active. If the mind is bright and alert, you need to do less. And you can just scan through the body, allowing for sensations to emerge. Is that speaking to a little bit of what you were wanting to know? Yeah. So it's just a couple of very simple ways of approaching this working with the body. Of course, there's walking meditation and all sorts of other things we could talk about, but we'll just leave it there for the moment. So tonight I was asked to speak about this topic, good meditation for life. It's a huge topic, isn't it? It's like life. That's pretty much everything. So I work as a bereavement counsellor, so I suppose I have to say death is something as well too. But life is huge. It encompasses everything. So I saw the topic and thought, gosh, that is huge. How can I approach this? And what I figured was implied in the question or the topic was not just life, but meditation for the sort of life that we want, for a good life. So maybe we could say good meditation for a good life. I think that's probably more to the point. I don't think we want to meditate to get a bad life. So, you know, we can do that without meditation. So meditation that helps us with the sort of life that we think is good. And that gives us a bit more, it's contained a bit more, if we say it that way. So we probably need to start by asking ourselves, what do we think the word good is and what do we think meditation is? So I've just talked about a couple of forms of meditation, so clearly it's more than just one thing. And I reckon if we went around and asked people what the word good means in terms of a good life, you may well talk about a number of different things. You know, your idea of good life might be getting onto Australian Idol or Malaysian Idol. I'm not sure. I'm sure there is one, isn't there? There must be. Indonesian Idol? There must got to be. And becoming famous. You know, that might be the idea of a good life. The idea of a good life, you might be passing your exams. I suspect that's a lot closer to home for a lot of you at the moment. The idea of a good life might be getting lots of money. The idea of a good life might be being able to sleep at night. I mean, there's a million different ways we can approach that. So we'd really need to ask ourselves, what do I think a good life is? That's a whole topic in itself. So I'll put that out there as something to think about along the way. And then meditation is all of this whole range of things as well across all sorts of traditions, not just Buddhist, but Christian, Sufi, Hindu, lots and lots of meditations as well. So again, it's quite a broad topic. So probably we need to start thinking what sort of ideas are helpful to move us in the direction of the sort of life we want using the meditation that's appropriate for that. Let's see what some people have said about the good life. So probably the most obvious person to talk about here is a guy called Martin Seligman. Martin Seligman is the sort of guru of positive psychology. Has anybody heard of positive psychology? It's one of the major forms of psychology around the world today. So any psychology students here tonight? I'm on safe ground. There's nobody here. That's great. Good. How many engineers are here tonight? Okay, all right. So I'm not talking about engineering at all. I'm not mentioning the word structure or anything else. So Martin Seligman is a big name in this field, positive psychology, and he's pulled up an old Greek word, eudaimonia. It actually means good spirits. So the word good is in there, good spirits. And he talks about a number of things that he thinks are part of a good life. He talks about generating positive emotions. Well, so does Buddhism, so we're on the same track there. He talks about engagement with the task at hand. He talks about making meaning out of our lives, and that will be somewhat different for each person. He's also added a couple of other things. He thinks relationships are important. That sounds right, doesn't it? Do you remember the Buddha said about Dharma friendships? When Ananda said to him, oh, they're quite important. And the Buddha said to Ananda, don't say that. They're the whole of the holy life. Dharma friendships, good friendships, are the whole of the holy life. We need good relationships, especially if we're going to practice Buddha's practice. And he thinks accomplishment as well. My eyes were closed when you took that photo, incidentally, so we'll try for another one. he talks about accomplishment. So the feeling that we are going where we want to go, that we're accomplishing what we want to accomplish, this is something that's important for him. And he has a number of strategies. And the first one he says about is about enhancing pleasure. He thinks it's good to enhance pleasure. And actually, a lot of the time, we are trying to enhance pleasure, aren't we? So he talks about savouring life, bringing conscious attention to savouring what's good. You know, savoury, we have sweet and we have savoury. When we're savouring something, we're really tasting something. So he thinks we should really taste our positive experiences. Notice when they're positive and actually, you know, really be present. Too often we miss our positive experiences, don't we? You know, they're gone and we concentrate on the negative experiences or the ones we're worried about in the future. So he says there's something important about just stopping for a moment and noticing the pleasant, savouring the pleasant, turning it into a skill. There's a guy called Rick Hansen too who talks a lot about neuroscience and how the brain works. And he's very much into cultivating positive emotions. Very much part of what he talks about. Martin Seligman says sharing with others is important. Absorption in what we're doing. So, you know, when you're enjoying something, how you are really absorbed in it and time passes very quickly, he thinks that's very important. It's called flow. There's a guy called Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi. Please don't ask me how to spell that. I've just remembered how to say it. And he is the person who talks about this notion of flow. When our lives are flowing, it feels good. Things are working for us. And he also thinks mindfulness is quite important as well, and I'll come back to that as well, because here we are in the territory of Buddhism very much. He thinks engagement, nurturing relationships and seeking out these flow experiences is a good idea. And finding meaning. And he says learning to forgive. Sometimes that means learning to forgive ourselves, doesn't it? Sometimes we're the hardest people to forgive. You know, in my job as a bereavement counsellor, I see people where often they've cared for somebody when they're very ill and they're dying, you know, incredibly well. And guess who they blame when the person dies? Any guesses? Themselves. They might blame the doctors, they might blame God, they might blame the universe. They sometimes blame the person who's died. Let's say they're a smoker and they died of lung cancer and they didn't give up their smoking. But more often than not, they tend to blame themselves and think about all the things they should have done or couldn't, you know, could have done or didn't do, and why didn't I? So sometimes forgiveness actually means forgiving ourselves. I don't know if anybody here has maybe occasionally got a mark on their exam that isn't quite as good as what they wanted. And, you know, most of me, when we get that, we start cursing ourselves. Oh, why didn't I? I wasted that time. There I was doing this and I should have done that. Or we go to a job interview. I don't know if anybody here has been for a job interview yet. And we come out of it and we immediately think of all the things that we should have said and didn't say. We never go straight to the good stuff. We go straight to the bad stuff. So this learning to forgive others also is a boomerang thing. We need to learn to forgive ourselves. So Martin Seligman's very strong on that. He says this is part of a good life. So getting more pleasure out of life, becoming more engaged in what we do, the good life, making your life feel more meaningful, the meaningful life, and combining all of those he calls the full life. So pleasant, good, meaningful. They're the three take-home words from Martin Seligman. Pleasant, good, meaningful. And if you combine those, he says you have a full and rich life. Something interesting, I said I'd say something about mindfulness, and I'll come back to this later again, and Buddhism. He says Buddhism only fits in the first category, and the first category is having a pleasant life. It's interesting, isn't it? When I think about Buddhism, I don't necessarily think about having a pleasant life. I think it's part of it, but it doesn't come to my mind first up as being the major part of Buddhism, or mindfulness for that matter either. So he says mindfulness helps us savour the pleasant experiences, and that's true. You know, around the world in some of the mindfulness courses that are run, we eat a raisin. Has anybody done the raisin exercise? And it's about learning to bring our attention to something that's interesting and possibly pleasant as well. So mindfulness is used to savour an experience. The experience for you might be having a shower, it might be playing with the dog, it might be, you know, resting, it might be reading. Although it's hard to be mindful when we're reading, my teacher in Burma says. He reckons the one thing where we can't be mindful is when we're reading. It's interesting because we're absorbed in the reading. So he thinks mindfulness helps us savour the pleasant. He thinks that's its proper place. As a Buddhist myself, and maybe some of you are as well, you might feel that there's a little more to it than that also. So we're going to explore that. Seligman's quite funny here, though. He says, though, that he notes the pleasant life, that's one of these factors in a good life, such as shopping or watching TV, you know, Australian Idol or whatever, is more likely to attract us in a search for meaning. So although he says, you know, finding meaning in our life is very important, often our meaning comes through searching for pleasure. So, you know, if we're going to find meaning in reading the Buddha Suttas or listening to a talk, that can be hard work. And often it's much easier for us just to go for the pleasant, you know, watching a bit of telly or eating something or, you know, talking with friends. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it's just interesting, some of these things that he talks about are much easier and some are much more challenging. And I think Buddhism offers some more challenging things for us to do as well. So is that enough for a good life, just to savour the pleasant and the good and the meaningful? Is that enough? Well, again, Seligman says something very interesting. See what you think about this. He says, you could argue that a serial killer leads a pleasant life. That's true, isn't it? That might be very pleasant for them. Presumably there is some pleasant reward for them, as horrible as that is. So a pleasant life doesn't necessarily mean a good life. A skilled mafia hitman leads a good life. They might lead a very good life. They might make lots of money from their profession. They've probably got a family who loves them at home. They're probably quite sentimental towards their family. That could count as a good life. And maybe they like being part of the mafia. They probably do. That they could see that as a good life. We might not, but they might see it as a good life. And a fanatical terrorist leads a meaningful life. Yeah. Isn't that true? Potentially true, at least. They think it's meaningful. You know, ridding the world of, let's say, unbelievers. Let's say that's why they're killing people. You know, making the way for a new world order, whether it's religious or whatever else. That provides a lot of meaning, unfortunately. And people thrive with a sense of meaning and purpose. So we have to be careful about even those three things, the pleasant, the good and the meaningful, because they can still be read in ways that I hope that we would think are unethical, not so useful, harmful for other people. And we know Buddhism talks about non-harm. It's absolutely central to Buddhism and, in fact, most religions, non-harm. So what did the Buddha say about this? Well, the Buddha had a lot to say about this, and I've just picked out one or two things, but I want to give you a statement about how to think about these three categories. He said, when visiting an awakened person, we should ask, what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? What will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? And there's quite a famous monk in the States called Tanjef Tanisaro, a wonderful writer, trained in Thailand for many years, back in America now. And he says, all too often we choose the more fleeting pleasure. Will I meditate or will I watch Australian Idol? I'm going to have to think of something else. I'm not picking on Australian Idol. I've watched it myself and enjoyed it. But all too often we choose the more fleeting pleasure. So often we don't ask the question of ourselves, let alone an awakened person, what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? It's such a simple thing to ask, isn't it? And, you know, we start thinking about the way we live our lives, and a lot of the way we live is very fast, complex, rapidly changing, lots of demands. How many, you know, when if you're working or even being a student, how many emails come into your inbox, or how many friends, you know, share Snapchat stuff with you? It's endless, right? And fast. You just got to get rid of stuff so you can get more stuff. So, you know, social media is very big in pushing the Buddha's question to one side, and actually we want to go, what's going to give me immediate gratification here and now? When we get out in the world of work, there's a lot of short-term contracts out there as well. You know, we're doing a job, we're always looking for the next one, trying to position ourselves to get the next job, the next contract. So it's quite challenging, you know. And we just have this amazing amount of information we have to deal with in a very short time. So one of the tools that we need is to be able to focus quickly on things, deal with it, move to the next thing. And funnily enough, this is a skill that's been drawn from mindfulness practice called attentional focus. And this is like a major area of interest for business and research. The idea is that if we can train people if we can maximise their ability to focus quickly, deal with something, move to the next thing, then we're going to maximise profits. So, you know, Buddhism was never really about maximising profits, but an aspect of it, attentional focus, is very interesting. I'm being a little unfair because people are also researching this because they think it's very healthy to be able to do that. But there's no doubt the business sees that as a tool of profit making. And you may think that's part of a good life. If you go on to be a CEO of a company, you might certainly think that's part of a good life if it maximises profits for the company. If meditation helps your employees be in better health, that's a good thing. In fact, I saw a slogan just a couple of days ago that says, health equals wealth in business. Health equals wealth. So if we can get our workforce healthy through meditation or whatever, we can turn a few more dollars. So it's interesting. You might think that's okay, and maybe it is okay, but I put it out there as an interesting idea, I think, about the way that aspects of meditation, particularly mindfulness, are being used in our society. Health is wealth. Mindfulness equals health equals wealth is sort of the formula. Interesting. So I've mentioned the word mindfulness a couple of times. Martin Selig mentions it. When we think about a good life and meditation, mindfulness is the preeminent method that comes to mind these days. Everybody here has heard of mindfulness, right? Yes, nobody's saying no, so I'm going to take the silence as a yes. Yeah, everybody's heard. Yeah, right, okay, everybody's heard of mindfulness. So mindfulness really became part of contemporary Western society, moving into many other countries now as well, in the late 70s with Jon Kabat-Zinn. He started this thing called mindfulness-based stress reduction. At the medical centre he was working at in Massachusetts. He had a whole lot of patients. He would see people who were suffering with chronic pain particularly. He'd done a lot of meditation practice, particularly in Korean Zen tradition, as it turns out, and I think that's heavily influenced his form of mindfulness. He'd done a lot of yoga, and he had inspiration on a retreat where he suddenly had a vision, about a 10-second vision, of mindfulness being deployed throughout the world to help people who are suffering so they could have a good life. That it'd be meditation for a good life, or good meditation for life. And he called it mindfulness because he knew that meditation back then, if you mentioned meditation in the late 70s, in a medical setting or a business setting, end of story. Nobody's going to pick up on that. So he called it mindfulness. So mindfulness became a catch-all for all sorts of other things. And he was applying that to people with chronic pain. It was very, very successful. And you would know it's spread around the world. It's in virtually every country around the world now. And that from there, it's moved into therapy. And from there, it's moved into business. It's also moved into the military as well. So mindfulness is really, it really is everywhere. There's been a few criticisms. Can you imagine what the criticisms are? What would be wrong with putting mindfulness into everyday life in all those forums? Okay, let me read a few criticisms. I just noted a few. First one is people are saying mindfulness has been taken out of Buddhism, it's distorting the practice and it's straying from its roots. It's being used for purposes other than what it was developed for. It's promoting a practice which is just relaxation, sort of, or attentional focus or symptom relief. Okay, these are not bad things necessarily. It's being marketed in a way where we can think, gosh, if I take up this mindfulness, I'll get some sort of idealised lifestyle. So when we think about seeing mindfulness out there in public, where do we see it? We see it mostly in magazines and newspapers, online. And what do we always see when we see images of mindfulness? We either see somebody in a business suit meditating, clearly the idea is this is good for business, or we see usually a very attractive woman, often in a leotard, almost never over about the age of 25. They're meditating blissfully. Who knows? Maybe they're thinking about chocolate. I don't know. They never tell us. But the idea is that this meditation will produce this idealised lifestyle of blissful, peaceful, happy, wealthy and so forth. It carries all these sorts of themes and it's being marketed quite heavily in that way. And, of course, once we market it, we can sell it. So clearly that would be a criticism from a Buddhist perspective because in a formal way, meditation was never sold. Mindfulness was never sold. It was integrated into the culture and offered really freely. So this is quite a strong criticism, I think. There can be a concern about qualifications. You know, what sort of mindfulness is it that people are teaching? There's lots of different sorts out there. There's mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, dialectical behaviour therapy. These are just the therapies. Acceptance commitment therapy. And they all have slightly different takes on mindfulness. Now, that doesn't make it wrong. It just means it's incredibly diverse. How do we measure it? Sometimes mindfulness is used unskillfully by some teachers, and it can promote fear, panic, anxiety, or open the way to old traumas. So it's not uncommon if people are meditating, and meditating more intensively, without working up to it, they can feel a degree of anxiety and shakiness. Let's go back to the example I gave before. If you're sitting there and your body starts to disappear, you can imagine that might promote some anxiety. If you've been traumatised growing up, maybe you've been hit a lot or verbally abused, and we've repressed that, sitting quietly with nothing much to do except paying attention can open the way for those things to re-emerge. Now, therapeutically, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe that's part of a good life for us. But if we're not ready for that, if we're not supportive for that, that can absolutely just blow us out of the water. So we need to be a little cautious about this mindfulness or meditation for a good life. Yeah, please, yes.
Isn't that more a criticism of the therapist rather than the technique? Opening up and somebody up and releasing all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think it's potentially both, actually. I think there are therapists who understand the difficult aspects of mindfulness, but it's not been a part of the conversation about mindfulness. It's nearly always presented in that rather romanticised, wonderful way where everything is good about mindfulness. For anybody here who's been on any long retreats, you will know, and this is for people who've been on long retreats, you will know that there are points in meditation that are extraordinarily difficult, extraordinarily existentially challenging, to really challenge our sense of who we are and what it means to be a human being and to be me. In therapy, we tend not to be doing long stretches of meditation. So I would say it's probably a criticism of the conversation about meditation and mindfulness up until now, that these potential concerns haven't been highlighted enough. So therapists who have done their training wouldn't be alerted to those facts because often they haven't done long-term training and they don't know it from their own side. So it's probably more about the training and the conversation. A practice is just a practice. How it's applied is the key thing, of course. But there is the potential in the practice for that. Fortunately, it's not overwhelming. It's not everybody. In fact, it's a minority, but it's still a little criticism that's come up in relation to that. Does that speak to what you're saying? Yeah. But I think, yes, it absolutely can also come down to the therapist, and usually about therapist training as well. A bit gung-ho with something they don't really understand because it's presented as being benign, always being good. But and just to remind you, if you want to ask questions or add something as we go along, please do. You know, we're sort of rapidly going through a lot of stuff here, so do stop me. It's better that we speak to what you're interested in rather than what I think you might be interested in. And I want to keep on the topic of this good meditation for life, so, you know, correct me if I'm going off topic here as well. And probably the major criticism, really from a Buddhist perspective, it can be used unethically. And I'll come back to that, what that means. So it can be used in a way where it just fits into the social norms, it doesn't critique society, and it can be used in ways that aren't really about liberation, but are more about getting something out of the person. I'm going to introduce you to mindfulness because I want something back from you. So we're not really alert to social issues, for example. In fact, we can use mindfulness to damp down our natural empathic response to social issues so we don't hear what's being said. Let me give you an example. So Google. We've all heard of Google. Okay, good. Yes, there's lots of nods, yes. Hard not to, really. So there's a conference that Google held in Feb 2014, and it was interrupted by Buddhist activists. And they leapt up on stages in the Bay Area in San Francisco, of course, and they jumped onto the stage and started to chant, "Wisdom means stopping displacement," because Google was expanding out into the Bay and people who had lived there for years, maybe low-income housing and so forth, were being pushed out of that area because Google was expanding so rapidly. "Wisdom means stop surveillance." And they claimed that Google shouldn't be speaking as experts on mindfulness, when they're playing a role in displacement, privatising public assets, for-profit surveillance, profiling, policing and so forth. So a lot of complaints. So, of course, they're removed from stage pretty quickly. And the Google spokesperson then said to the people in the audience, because they were talking about mindfulness, check in with your body. Feel what it's like to be in conflict with people with heartfelt ideas. So you see what's being done there. It's about self-soothing. How do I feel? Oh, I'm agitated. And there's a sense of soothing oneself. The concerns of the activists disappear. So mindfulness can be used as a way of soothing, I guess we could say soothing our conscience, so we don't hear difficult things. We just, oh, something difficult has happened, I'll use mindfulness to soothe myself, to come back to my body, to release, to open up. And it may be that we use that in a way to ignore what's going on around us. Very possible. You may disagree with that. This is just one person's view. Well, this is actually what happened. So there are two terms I came across. One I've known for a while, but there's a new term I learned. And I think they're great because they summarise some of the complaints or concerns about the way that mindfulness meditation is being used for this good life. The two terms are the mindful sniper and the mindful zombie. So the mindful sniper is someone who uses mindfulness in unethical ways. So a sniper is somebody who has a rifle and it shoots, you know, it shoots people one person at a time. They're sharpshooters. And, you know, certainly Ajahn Sumedho, a very famous monk, American monk now back in Thailand, talked about, you know, using mindfulness in ways which aren't considered skillful within Buddhism. And he talked about snipers, you know, way back when. That is, we can use this as a form of attentional focus, of calming the mind, you know, breathing in, I calm myself, you know, breathing out, I'm, you know, pull the trigger. And we could conceivably become better sharpshooters, mindful snipers. You know, and actually the army is using mindfulness to help soldiers in various ways, which we won't go into this evening, but that's just put it out there to think about. So there was a guy called Anders Breivik only a few years back, an island off the coast of Norway, you remember, and he shot all those children who were out on a camp. He used meditation to help suppress his responses to the human reactions that he thought he would experience. So it may not have been mindfulness meditation. What I read about it didn't tell me the form of meditation, but clearly, you know, meditation for a good life, well, I guess if we'd asked him, he would have thought he was doing something meaningful. Whether we think that's meaningful and whether meditation should fit in with that is something else again. These are quite serious questions to think about. We tend to think about meditation as just inherently being good, right? It's good. Meditation must be good. It's Buddhist, it's whatever else, it's Christian, whatever, Sufi, it's Hindu. It must be good. But it depends what purpose we put it towards, and I'll come back to that in just a tick. The other one is the mindful zombie. Now, I know we all know about zombies because zombie movies are huge, right? Television movies, whatever. So the mindful zombie is where mindfulness is being used merely to enhance things like productivity or performance. So we're not interested in people waking up to themselves or self-liberating, any of those things. Our aim might simply to be to use mindfulness to maintain the status quo. It's very interesting because let's say we work in a business. Rather than saying, gee, maybe there's an issue with the business, maybe there's an issue with consumer capitalism, I'm going to say there's an issue with TAS and, you know, we need a better worker. So mindfulness is going to help him work better. You know, so I introduce mindfulness, so it becomes my problem. If I can just meditate better or be more mindful, I'll be more productive and healthier as well. So it can be a way of shifting attention from the society we live in or the structure that we're in and putting it back on us again. It's a highly individualised form of meditation that says, you know, you guys are all masters of your own destiny. If there's a problem at business, well, the problem must sort of be with you because you're not managing the issue well. So it's up to you to manage the issue. Now, it's interesting because mindfulness and meditation generally says, you know, we do want to learn to manage things better for ourselves. So there's some sort of dividing line that will be different for each of us that says, when is it not okay just to make this a personalised practice? When does it need to be a social or cultural practice? it may be a practice that critiques what's going on. Now, if we think about the Buddha leaving home, we could imagine that there was a bit of a critique of his current life going on. If he hadn't critiqued his current life, he wouldn't have left home. It all would have been fine. So clearly, even from the early days, Buddhism had contained within the seeds of Buddhism a sort of critique, an investigative aspect that looked not just at the self, but at what one did in society and how society works. So if mindfulness is used to produce mindful zombies, or if we use it to zombie out, it's probably not really a Buddhist practice. But you might think that's an okay practice for certain things. So any questions about that? Disagreements? Thoughts? Mindful sniper, mindful zombie. I think we can pretty clearly say from a Buddhist perspective these are not the sorts of mindfulness or meditation that would lead to the sort of life that we think is good or that we want. These various approaches to mindfulness, you may have heard this, have been called McMindfulness because they've been franchised and they're being sold. So, you know, you've heard of McDonald's, McMindfulness. Same thing except applied to mindfulness. So the product becomes mindfulness. You know, can I get some mindfulness to go? I've got 10 minutes, here's my money, give me the product. That might be okay as well, but maybe it's not. Okay. So John Kabat-Zinn says something very interesting about mindfulness, however. He says that mindfulness is the essence of Buddhism. It's the essence of the Dharma. So the Dharma is the old word for... before Buddhism was the word Buddhism was sort of invented by Westerners, Western translators, was Dharma practice before that. So he says he's drawn out the essence of the practice, and it's found in what he says is mindfulness. And there might be a part of us that agrees with that, because mindfulness is clearly, you know, insight practice is central to Buddha's practice. But that's interesting, because what he's really saying is he's taken a practice out of the culture, out of its historical place, and it's this standalone thing that can be delivered to anybody, regardless of their culture and so forth. I think there's quite a few dangers with that. Is there anything that stands alone from culture, from history, from its background, from its formations? Is mindfulness something that is the same across all cultures? Is it used for the same sorts of things? I think the answer clearly is no. If we say that mindfulness, we can draw it out as a thing in and of itself, out of its context, what some people have said, a guy called Sam Harris, for example, is we can just get rid of the accidental stuff like Buddhism. That's just cultural. We can get rid of that. You know, that's just an accident of history. Now that we Westerners know better, it can find its true purpose, which is to work with science. Isn't that a sort of a culture? That's just another culture. We just privilege science over... you know, other forms of, you know, old Buddhism, it's been called, which is pretty dismissive, don't you think? And sort of not very clear-headed. So when people talk about having the essence of the practice for a good life, I'm just stand back a little bit and think, well, I don't see that anything exists outside of its formations. In fact, that's what the Buddha said. Everything is conditioned. So to say, I've got the one thing that's not conditioned, is an interesting statement and not a Buddhist statement, I don't think, at all. So when we say we want a good meditation for life, we need to understand the meditation that we're going to focus on is found within the context of our lives. So each of you might choose different aspects of meditation because you have your own context. So I can't just deliver the best meditation for a good life to you. You need to work with this for yourselves. Find your own essence, perhaps I can say, of the Dharma. So how is this mindfulness different from Buddhist mindfulness? We should probably come back to Buddhism at this point. Well, we know that Buddhism is set within a context. It has a context, not just one thing. Think of the Eightfold Path, for example. Mindfulness is, or insight practice is one aspect of that context. We have the Four Noble Truths. That's a map, that's a context. When I say context, it's the geography that mindfulness fits into. So we're in a university context here. a Buddhist group context. And mindfulness from Buddhism sits in that context. It doesn't work alone. And it's actually called right mindfulness, sammasati. Sati is the word for mindfulness. It's right. Right suggests there's a wrong mindfulness. When I introduce this idea to Westerners, I don't know how you guys feel about this, there's usually pushback. So the idea of right mindfulness sounds exclusive and, you know, restrictive and patriarchal and all sorts of bad things. But what does it mean in terms of Buddhism to say right mindfulness or right meditation? It means it fits into this context. There is a path, there is a method, and there is a goal. Context means our lives have a context, we have a path we're walking, and we have a goal or various goals, and meditation fits into a particular path in Buddhism. The goal of meditation is liberation. So mindfulness is turned towards helping us understand what liberation is right here and now. And from a Buddhist perspective, if we're using it merely as a self-help technique, merely to pass exams, well, that's a very good use for it, merely to make money, merely to be able to shoot somebody, these are not very skillful or are forms of mindfulness, some less skillful than others. Thoughts about any of that so far? How are we travelling?
So you're getting more to a moral aspect.
Yeah, I think so. There's an ethical and moral aspect, yes, yeah. That's an important question because we sometimes conflate ethics and values. So we can have an ethical part, but sometimes we bring quite different values to what we're doing as well. So it's important that we explore for ourselves, what are my values? What do I actually really believe in? Because what we choose as good meditation will depend on the values that we hold, the goals we have. Ethics is something we can sort of put on top of that, and we want to practice ethical behaviour, but underneath that very much is really what's driving us, is what we value too. But it's very much a sort of a moral, yes, it definitely has this moral aspect, there's no doubt. And Westerners tend not to like that either, because that sounds very restrictive and, you know, your morals may not be mine and so forth. Anybody feeling restricted? Closed in? Okay. So it's got to fit into a coherent path. It's got to make sense within the context of a path. And mindfulness, from a Buddhist perspective, needs to illuminate why we're suffering. What is it that causes us suffering, dis-ease, being uncomfortable, right down at the core? And the Buddha didn't really talk about not enough money making us unhappy, not being a CEO making us unhappy. He talked about some fundamental ways of relating to our experience such that because we misperceive what's going on, we suffer. That's what he was interested in. So he deployed this tool called sati, mindfulness, to help us uncover what's going on. And this is sometimes where mindfulness within Buddhism is a little uncomfortable, because we always think that change is good and we'll uncover things about ourselves, but sometimes what we uncover can be feel a little destabilising. So we come back to this body thing we talked about earlier. If we uncover that in fact this body's not as solid as I thought it was, that can be uncomfortable. Maybe we don't want to uncover that. If we uncover that our thoughts come and go in and of themselves, maybe that would be very uncomfortable for us. If we uncover that this body is subject to old age, sickness and death, maybe that's uncomfortable. Try having that conversation about mindfulness out there. See how far you go. You know, I do mindfulness. What's that about? It's about uncovering we get old, we get sick and we die. It could be a really short conversation, right? But if you say, I'm doing mindfulness, what's that about? Oh, it's about making more money, being happier and healthier and wealthier. That could be quite a long conversation. Could take the rest of your life. It's not a bad conversation to have, but it's not really where Buddhism was coming from, not what it was aiming at either. So we know that sati, or you should know that sati comes from the verb sarati, to remember. It just means remembering. And it means remembering in a couple of different ways. It means having a presence of mind. I'll talk about that in a minute. And it means recalling, remembering the Buddhist teachings and being guided by them. So sometimes sati in modern mindfulness, often it's talked about as bare attention. Bare attention means we're just being present to what's going on. It's a very common phrase. Some of you here will have heard it. You probably heard it here, people talking about mindfulness practice. However, in Buddhism, whilst that's part of mindfulness practice, it's a beginning part. Just bringing the mind to the present moment. Presence of mind contains bare attention. We're remembering to be present. Acharya Buddhaghosa in the Visuddhimagga, which I think was the 8th century, am I right in saying that? It's a famous meditation manual. I think it's the 8th century, but I could be wrong. It doesn't really matter, I suppose. He said that mindfulness helps stop the mind from wobbling. So it gives it a certain solidity. It keeps it present, on track. It stops it from wobbling. I quite like that translation. So if you're sitting there and your mind is wobbling, you're probably not being mindful. Mindfulness gives it a stability, our attention stability. Mindfulness pays attention to what else is going on. So it's present to not just the breath, but it's present to what we're doing with our experience. This is really a key part of mindfulness. It's absolutely central in Buddhist practice, and it's central for having a good life. We need to be noticing two things when we're meditating using this practice. One is what we call the object of attention. It could be the breath. It might be a sensation. It might be a mantra. It could be anything, really, any object. But the second question is at least as important as the first. The first thing is, what's the object I'm paying attention to? The second thing we really need to notice is, what's my relationship with what's going on? What am I doing with this experience? Am I leaning into it? Do I like it? Is there pleasure? Do I want more of it? You know, we're paying attention to a nice smell. That's a meditation object. What's our relationship with the smell? Well, maybe we're, like those old cartoons, we're leaning into it and wafting off with the smell. Or maybe we're trying to get more of it. Oh, I love that smell. I don't want to think it's Christmas cake or something like that. I don't know what sort of smell you like, you know. And to notice that. Or perhaps we're doing the opposite. We're trying to get rid of something, a noise. We don't like a noise. There's a plane or somebody's moving next to us and we're trying to meditate. And we think, I wish they'd stop. You know, we're trying to either block them out or push them away. We want less of it. They're just styles of relationship. And it's interesting when we start noticing, we're nearly always just, the body and mind produce a relationship of liking or not liking. And the reason that's so important, it's so obvious, isn't it? But the reason it's so important is from that comes wanting, not wanting. You know, greed, grasping, craving, aversion, pushing away, anger. So from these primal responses of being present to something and having a sort of a movement of the mind, what we call an affective movement of the mind, it's not yet built up into a big emotion, but there's a feeling quality to it, pleasant or unpleasant, the rest comes from there. This is absolutely central as a meditation practice for this topic tonight. Because if we want good meditation for life, we have to acknowledge life comes at us. We can't predict everything that happens. Fortunately, there is some degree of predictability. It's not chaotic. But life comes at us. It presents stuff that we didn't see coming or that we feared and arrives anyway. What about getting older? We know that's coming, but it still takes us by surprise. I was in watching a movie many years ago down in Melbourne, a long time ago, and I was eating some popcorn. And one of the corn kernels hadn't popped, and I went crunch. And part of my tooth broke off. I was only in my 20s. And I remember my very first thought was, but that doesn't happen to me. That was really my first thought. You know, it's very interesting to see that. You know, it caught me. Life caught me by surprise. So life throws these things at us. And sometimes we don't have much choice. I didn't know that kernel of corn was going to go crunch and break a bit of my tooth, which is still broken, incidentally. What's important here is the relationship we have with what life brings to us. What are we bringing to life? Often we're trying to structure life so that we get what we want. And here in Australia, it's very easy to do that, comparatively speaking. We walk into this room, we turn on the sun. How fantastic. And we know pretty much every time we walk in the room, we're going to be able to turn on the sun. We go waiting for a bus. Mostly it turns up roughly on time. It doesn't turn up tomorrow. It usually turns up in 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes at the time. We think that's bad. So we get used to life giving us what we want, more or less in Australia, I think. More or less. we're not very practiced at life bringing these other things to us. So the question for us in relation to the topic is, what do we bring to life? If we want good meditation for life, what's our relationship like when these things happen? Similarly, what's our relationship like when something really pleasant comes up? Do we want more of it? Do we get caught up in it? Of course we do. Of course we do. Of course we want more. But we can get very, very caught up. So I'll mention something quite serious, and that's pornography. Now, there is certainly a part of our experience that for some people that wants more and more of that. Now, in the past, it was very difficult to get that. These days, of course, as we know with the internet, it's absolutely online. It's there all the time. It's the number one thing on the internet. And virtual reality is coming soon. You know it's going to be the number one thing with virtual reality, don't you? It's going to be pornography. But there's no doubt. Of course it's going to be that. We all know it's true. We're all smiling. We all know it's true. So we have this tendency towards addiction for pleasant things. And if we can get more of them, we tend to want more of them. And the more we do it, the more we want. It's often been said the brain doesn't care what we do. If we repeat something, we train the brain to want more of it. If we perform skillful actions, the brain learns, and we learn, to perform that more frequently. But similarly, if we're doing stuff that's not helpful for us over and over and over, guess what we keep doing? The thing we've been practicing. We just don't see it as practice. So this is the problem with things like pornography, like drugs, for example, some drugs. We have the potential for addiction. And so the Buddha was very keen that we didn't just notice what was unpleasant, that movement towards rejection or pushing away, but we also notice the pleasant. Not to pretend it's not there or try and be an ascetic and push it away and go, I'll just have to whip myself a bit to make sure I don't experience the pleasant. We're not doing that. But we like to see how it works. So this meditation that helps us construct a good life is one that sees into what's actually going on for ourselves. And noticing this movement, often of the body itself, towards pleasant or unpleasant, is really important. That's a whole meditation practice. It's called Vedana Nupassana. It's the second of the four foundations of mindfulness. Try and find anything in your experience that doesn't have an affective tone to it. Slightly pleasant, slightly unpleasant, wanting more, wanting less. We talk about a neutral feeling, but mostly we're in movement. Towards or away from, towards or away from, pushing away, inviting in. Anyway, I put that out there for you to explore, really. It's a very, very valid and powerful form of meditation. What am I bringing to life? What am I bringing to my own life? How am I doing my own life? Not just what does life bring to us. If I meditate, I'll be able to figure out all the stuff out there and put all the bits in place. What's my reaction to life? You know, this sounds a bit grim, but my feeling is it's better to practice now before too much bad stuff happens, potentially. I hope you get through lovely lives and nothing really bad ever happens to you. You won't get much wisdom, but that would be a pleasant way of getting through life, going back to Martin Seligman. There's not much wisdom in there. Most of our wisdom comes from suffering, unfortunately, I think. So if we are going to have a degree of suffering, even if we don't get the job we don't want, let alone any major suffering, the question is, what do we do with that? What's our relationship with life? This is a very strong aspect of Buddhist meditation that helps us construct what we think of as a good life. That's all the Buddha was doing for himself. He was constructing a good life. Right livelihood for him was being a monk. It's not that way for everybody, but it was for him. So sati also has this quality of remembering the teachings, being guided ethically by the teachings. So in early Buddhism, for example, we would be paying attention to, we're watching our thoughts. We want to know whether those thoughts are there as the texts say, with passion, whether it's anger or incredible attraction and desire. So we're noticing the quality of your mind. Once again, Buddhist teachings say, pay attention to what we're doing to life. We're remembering the teachings in that respect. We're noticing if we're generating unwholesome thoughts. So the notion in early Buddhism certainly is to generate a wholesome mind state. So we're actually doing something in the practice. So sati is more than just bare attention. If we want to construct a good life, we would like to be more attentive to what we're doing with our experience. And actually, sati is fundamentally, from the perspective of early Buddhism, about uncovering three very fundamental things. Number one is impermanence, and I talked about that with the meditation practice. And impermanence is another word for change. Ceaseless, relentless, unstoppable change. The second one is suffering, or dukkha. And you remember dukkha, there's the image of the wheel that doesn't turn quite well on its axle, that rubs against the axle. I was in Burma quite some time ago. I guess it must have been 90-something, I think 94 or something, and we went on an arms round out through, well, there was still some forest around the monastery at that stage, and along this little track came a bullock cart, you know, bullock, a big cow, pulling this old wooden cart with the great big wheels on it. And the wheels were very reminiscent of what's meant here by dukkha. They were squeaky and they were grinding. They weren't sitting, they weren't spinning smoothly on the axle. This is the sense of dukkha, the friction. We haven't got time for this tonight, but friction and heat and fire are very interesting in early Buddhism. Fire in early Buddhism is a metaphor for clinging, craving, which causes suffering. So when we talk about dukkha, we're talking about friction, we're talking about fire. The Buddha said, everything's on fire. And by that he meant there's friction with everything. Contact produces friction. What are we going to do with that friction? Are we going to let it blow up into a big fire of jealousy, a big fire of hatred? Or are we going to cultivate a way of removing the fuel so the fire doesn't burn any longer? Cool down the flame, this notion of nirvana. So that's number two, the second thing we're looking for in this practice to create a good life. And the third thing is not self, anatta. The sense that wherever we look, we can't find a me that can hold on to anything. And the attempt to hold on to something, to a sense of me, you know, as though it's mine, I can stop change, produces suffering. So we're very much looking from a mindfulness perspective in early Buddhism at those three things. So we're coming towards a conclusion, but just before we get there, thoughts so far, things to add?
Just to clarify,
please do, yeah.
The meditation, one is to pay with sati, pay attention to the breath.
Or whatever the object is, that's right, yes, yeah.
And the second part of sati is remembering, reflecting in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
On those three aspects.
That there's two ways of thinking about that second part of the meditation. So the second part, first of all, we can notice in meditation itself, what the quality of the mind is. Is it a mind that has a lot of friction in it one way or another? Is it a friction of aversion or a friction of desire? And we can then adjust accordingly. The second part of it that you're mentioning as well is more like contemplation. So somebody like Achan Sumedho is very strong on contemplation and very powerful, especially if we've been meditating, then we're contemplating, you know, maybe questions of ethics or questions of, you know, what was the experience I had or who am I, those things. You know, why am I suffering? And going deeply into that, that level of meditative contemplation is also a way of reflecting on the Buddha's teachings and bringing them to your own experience. Really important.
It's different. It's very simple to observe the physical.
Yep.
I find it more difficult to observe the mental and thought
process. Yeah. Look, yeah. Typically when people teach meditation and mindfulness meditation particularly, they start with something very obvious, like the body. And so I introduced us, and many of you will have done this many times before, to noticing the sensations in the body, the big sensations, the touch sensations. They're obvious. And we can notice them anywhere. They're very portable too. So we can do meditation when we're walking around, sitting in an exam. We just need to tune into the body sensations. They're very obvious. From there, we might move into the sense field. So we might notice something like hearing is a very good meditation. Noticing the arising and passing away of sounds. And that gets more and more refined as we go along. And then we start noticing, oh, and with the body as well, there's a sort of tone to this. I like this, I don't like it, I'm pushing it away. I'm trying to adjust my body to make it better, to get a more pleasant feeling. Or we start feeling pleasant and we notice we're moving into it and trying to pump it up more. It's very possible to do that in meditation. Rather than investigating, we're cultivating a particular way of being. That's actually okay as a meditation, as long as you know you're doing it. If we don't see we're doing it, we can get very much addicted to doing that. And when we don't get that pleasant feeling, we get very unhappy. So the meditation can actually contribute in the long run to suffering if we're not seeing that we're doing that. But pleasant feelings are a very good thing, and it helps calm the mind eventually and can help us focus because we have less distraction because it's pleasant. We like doing it. Moving to the mind, thoughts are remarkably fast. Mostly when we're talking about thoughts, I think we're talking about what we remember of the thinking process, not the actual process itself. I had a thought that began here and finished here. My own feeling about that, for what it's worth, is that when a thought emerges, the attention, the conscious attention we bring to it is always just after the event itself. I think we're always playing catch-up with experience. That's another topic for another night as well. But as we move into noticing thinking, what can really help us here with any subtle process, something like labelling, noting. So if you are moving into more subtle aspects of experience, begin by putting a mental label or note on it. Now, after a while, you won't need that because the mind gets very sharp. But, you know, thoughts are, you know, they're infinitesimally fast. You know, you can get down to like a 16th of a second of noticing each thought as it comes and goes. In fact, if you're noticing at that level, the thought tends not to come up any further. It just stops there because it doesn't have any juice. There's no friction to make it burst into flame. So if you're noticing at that very minute level, it tends to just disappear, and there are periods without thought. But we want to start in a sort of sequential way and start with the body, I think, move to some one of the sense fields, whichever one, it could just be staying with the body, notice the feeling quality, pleasant, unpleasant, what am I doing with my experience, and then you will begin to notice thoughts more clearly, and the labelling process really helps, such as we do in Burma. It's a technique that assists us. I may have gone slightly off track with your question there, but hopefully that speaks to it as well, yeah.
Actually, in the last talk, one of our speakers actually mentioned about how Nepal is like one of the happiest countries in the world, mm-hmm. because people there think about death contemplation 5 times a day.
Yes.
And, yeah. And I went to do a bit of research on that, and yeah. I went to look at one of the sutta, and basically found about there were 9 different ways to do some death contemplation.
Cemetery contemplations, yes, cemetery, all of that. Yes, asubha, the unpleasant, yeah, yeah.
Yes. So I'm actually a little bit confused about how to actually approach the death contemplation.
Yeah. Look, the Buddha was very cautious about teaching the contemplation of death to lay people. Really important. That was traditionally taught to monks, renunciates, and some nuns as well. Rarely to lay people. There's, I think, a more contemplative way of coming of thinking about death that's more useful for us. And you're right in my field here now, of course, you know. There's lots been written about when people realise that they are approaching the end, usually when they've got cancer or some diagnosis. And a couple of things can happen. One is people can come up with a lot of regrets about the way they didn't live their life. So there was an article written for the Guardian newspaper a few years ago, turned into a small book called Top 5 Regrets of the Dying. Top 5 Regrets of the Dying. By a woman, an Australian woman who'd worked in hospice and then went to England, was nursing people. Now, I want to say here that the top 5 regrets, as she heard them, she just wrote down what people said when they were coming towards the end of their lives. It's not the top 5 regrets for everybody. We shouldn't think this is a quantitative study. It's a qualitative study. Things like regretting that they hadn't maintained relationships, that they hadn't allowed themselves to love enough, things like this. So people can have a lot of regrets at the end of their life. And my view is, if you contemplate that the end is coming for all of us, why don't we construct a good life now rather than waiting for that to happen and going, gosh, it's all a bit too late. But the other thing that's very inspirational is that people, when they do realise, really realise that they're coming towards the end, but they've still got a bit of time, they rededicate themselves to life. So there's a guy from the band Wilco, a very old band that I read about in England, who got a cancer diagnosis some years back. He's since in remission now. So he said as soon as he found out, his lifelong depression disappeared because he was absolutely focused on living. And I see this a lot in my job after somebody's died with the family or friends who come along. Often they'll say things like, why did I waste time worrying about all that small stuff? You know, what's really important, and they usually say a variation of, is relationship. Relationship with myself, relationship with other people. That's what it comes down to. And so people rededicate themselves to life. So the very famous, I guess we can call him a neurologist, Oliver Sacks, died quite recently. He wrote that famous book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. about a particular medical condition where he really did see a hat when he saw his wife. He's a very interesting guy. He wrote a couple of beautiful articles, I think probably for the New York Times. One of those has now come out in a book called Gratitude, I think. But you can find it in the New York Times if you want to have a look. And he wrote about how he had his cancer diagnosis and how he just recommitted himself to all the things that he felt were good. Now, it wasn't meditation, but it was contemplative. It was contemplation. And he rededicated his energy, said, thank goodness I'm alive, I can still do these things. So there is something about the contemplation of death in that sort of way, more cognitive, that can really help us figure out what we mean when we want good meditation for life, what this good life is. Very practical. We've got to be very careful, though, that we don't get into some sort of depression, and it knocks us over sideways, and this body is mortal, and all suffering and sores will start, and, you know, it falls apart, and my teeth will fall out. We'll have popcorn, and our teeth will break, you know. It can make us all very sad about our poor me being a human being. So we've gone too far the other way when that happens, and we need to do a meditation, perhaps, which opens us up to the pleasant, to the possibilities of being human. I mean, the other thing is, thank goodness we're human. There's just enough suffering to push us along, but hopefully not so much that we're overwhelmed and we can't work out what it means to have a good life. So contemplation of death at whatever level can be very, very useful. Please, yeah.
Since we're on the topic of assisted meditation.
Yeah, right, yes.
I was curious, like, do you subscribe to the belief that some meditations are better for different personality types? For example, a super meditation better for people where greed is the...
Yeah, yeah. So the question is, are there some meditations that are better for some personality types, really, some types of people? Certainly that's true in terms of capacity. Some people have very fast minds and can turn their attention to things like cognitive processes very quickly. Others are much more affectively oriented towards feeling, and they're much better off working with meditations around that because it's a natural field for them to work in. It may well be, and I think what you're pointing to here is that sometimes we want to counter certain attributes we have with the opposite, with a meditation that corrects that. So we might be overly interested in pleasure, and we might contemplate the nature of the body as essentially disintegrating. You know, we might go to a cemetery and we don't have charnel grounds anymore where the bodies are decomposing, not in Australia anyway. We can go and sit amongst the corpses and see them decompose. There's a lesson there. And again, I wouldn't recommend that for anybody. I did once go down to watch as a crematorium down south. And I went with my bereavement team. And the guy was showing us around the back scenes to see the coffin come in. And we didn't see a body being put into one of the these fabulous German burners. But without warning, he threw open one of the doors and there's the skeleton in there burning away. It's like, oh, okay, right, there it is. You know? I can tell you, he also took us into a back room after that. He was remarkably matter-of-fact because this is just his day job. You know, it's what he does every day. And he took us into the back room and he said, look, I'll show you how we make, you know, we have all these bones that we have to get out afterwards. We put them they're in a drum. This is drum, we would call them a 4-gallon drum, I suppose, like this, you know, a container. And it's spinning around, it's going bang, 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 bang. And I'm going, what's that? So he stops it, he opens the flap, and there's all this ash in there from somebody's bones, and there's these big ball bearings in there. And so as it turns around, the ball bearings go around and smash all the bones into powder. So, you know, this is a very interesting learning for us, you know. The other thing he did then was he reached in and he got something out, and he threw it into the bin and it went clang, and it was a hip joint that somebody, you know, like somebody had obviously had a hip joint, because they take out any other things that might explode, but the hip joints go into the fire basically, and then they go bang, 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 and they bing. And I looked in the bin in the corner and it's half full of hip plate replacements, you know. So it was an interesting contemplation of death, you know. I'm not sure as bereavement counsellors we particularly needed to go there to counter anything else. But, you know, if you thought a corrective was needed, you could do it. I'd probably proceed pretty gently with that. I'd probably want to be reasonably good at my meditation and feel like I'd got a few meditation miles under, you know, under my belt, a few frequent flyer points before I went and did that, you know. I'm not sure if that's flying first class or cattle class, but whatever it is, I want to get a few, you know, points under the belt first. And the mind needs to be stable for those things. If we're unstable, then no, we should just play to our strengths for sure. Gently, gently.
Please, yeah. Could you perhaps categorize types of meditation into, like, for example, for beginner level, which type of meditation should start with, and then on to an advanced level? So maybe some people here who are new to meditation know where to start.
Yeah. Look, the meditation we did early on is a very safe meditation to do. It's just a sitting meditation. We turn to the breath of the body, again, those sensations I talked about, obvious sensations, and we simply attend to those over a period of time. For some people, 3 minutes is plenty. I've had people do mindfulness classes where after 3 minutes they're really twitchy and they're starting to get anxious. For some people, sitting still is very difficult, so walking meditation or any active meditation where you have to remember to bring your mind to be present, washing the dishes would be a great example of that. You know, a really pleasant thing to do for mindfulness training is remember to be present when you're having a shower, right? For most of us, a shower is pleasant, most people are nodding, I met a guy who's now very very central in the mindfulness field, contemporary mindfulness field, called Professor Mark Williams. He's now at Oxford, I think, and he was down at Bangor University in Wales back then, back around 2000, 2001. And he told a story which I'm going to amplify a little bit. But he wrote a very famous book called Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy for Prevention of Relapse into Depression. It's a bit of a mouthful. It's a good book. And he wrote it with a few other people. But he hadn't actually meditated before or done mindfulness meditation, but he's writing a book about it and how to use it in therapy for depression. So he thought to himself, which is unusual for an academic, I think, I should do some of this practice myself. You know, I can't just be a teacher. I probably need to have some experience under my belt, a few frequent flyer points myself. So they went to see John Kabat-Zinn in action. They brought back some ideas and worked with those. But one of the things he thought was, well, I better try and be mindful during the day. So he'd get up in the morning, he'd have his shower, be in the shower, and he'd start thinking, right, I've got that faculty meeting today, so I'd better speak to the secretary about that and just organise where that's going to be and who's coming along. Oh gosh, I've got that PhD student, I've got to talk to them. So I'm going to have to get in touch, I'll have to email them maybe and figure out when that's going in. Then there's that board meeting, and you know, before long, to paraphrase him, the whole faculty was in the shower with him. You know, so really his meditation practice was to shower alone. So if you want a simple practice that's safe for beginners, shower alone, okay? Or if you're going to shower with somebody, know you're showering with somebody, whether they're real or virtual, you know what you're doing. Ram Dass, a famous teacher, used to say, be here now. So any practice where you have to be here now, in your body, knowing what's going on, that is a good beginner's practice. We've already talked about some more advanced practices. Usually they would take more time. They'd be in slightly more specialised conditions. And you would have support from at least one other experienced meditator who's trodden some of that path before you. Most important. You know.
So you mentioned Vedadanupassana.
Yes, Vedana, yes, yeah.
Can you perhaps explore a bit more?
Vedana is the second one of the four foundations of mindfulness, Vedana Nupassana, investigation of feeling. Feeling here means more like sensation, pleasant or unpleasant sensations. We're not talking about feelings. We're not talking about emotions, not at this point. We're talking about something much more primal, and that is pleasant or unpleasant sensations. Now, these are pleasant or unpleasant sensations of the body, but also of the mind, which is a more difficult practice again. The inclination of the mind towards a thought that's interesting, that's stimulating. We can see that at that very minute level as well. And if we catch that, that's very interesting. Now, there's a very interesting point in practice. But that would be a more advanced way of using Vedana Nupassana. But we can come back to just pleasant or unpleasant. We can do it for a little meditation session. Just go through the body and notice, is it pleasant or unpleasant? And notice what we do with that. This is the key aspect. So if I'm sitting here and I have a slight pain here, which I do from hours and hours of meditation, and it just sort of set in there, how am I reacting to that? How am I responding to it? Am I even seeing what I'm doing? Am I jigging around and moving without even knowing? It's possible. Am I noticing it and choosing to move so I try and get rid of the pain? Am I noticing it and trying to move so I maximise any pleasure I get? Am I simply being present to that unpleasant sensation? Am I seeing it as unpleasant sensations, or as am I having a reaction that says, my pain is unbearable, this is really not fair, they shouldn't make me sit for so long? I've done that myself when I first started learning meditation. I didn't realise we had to sit for a long time. And my mind's going furiously, this pain's unbearable, why have they made us sit this long? Don't they know we're beginners? Westerners aren't used to sitting on the floor. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. Pain, 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 getting bigger. So that's a very gross example of what we do. When we have unpleasant feeling of mind or body, we build on it. And the flame caused by that friction is huge, and it burns, it hurts, it's dukkha. So we have an immediate experience, pleasant or unpleasant. How are we responding? Now, there's nothing wrong with moving away from the painful. The pain is there for it to tell us that we should be moving away from it. Or indeed moving towards the pleasant. Same, it's a signal. But if we didn't have those signals, we'd be burning ourselves and knocking ourselves and hurting ourselves all the time. There are some unfortunate people who don't have a lot of sensation, physical sensation, and they're really a danger to themselves and other people. You know, stand in a fire and not notice that your feet are on fire. That has happened to some people. So we need to notice, you know, what's the response? And try not to be too judgmental, but notice, oh, that's what I do when this experience happens. My body automatically moves. That's interesting. Because then we're seeing, in a sense, almost an aspect of not self. Oh, when there's this, there's that. When there's a pain, the body does this. That's very interesting to see, because we really wake up to the fact that, wow, this stuff is going on as a matter of cause and effect. Because normally I'd say, you know, why did you move? And you say, oh, I was feeling painful. When we start to pay attention, movement happened because there was pain. And then we noticed it and we claimed it as mine. I did that. Mostly we claim it when it's something really clever. You know, we like to blame somebody else when it's something really bad. I moved because somebody put me on this dreadfully hard seat. You know, it's not my fault. I moved because I was opening up into Nibbana. We like to claim that for ourselves. There's a big I in that one. So noticing how we're reacting to experiences is why coming back to Vedana is very important.
So basically we observe the arising and ceasing of feelings.
That is the idea, the arising and ceasing of feelings, if we can do that. It's a difficult one to do because we very often get caught in them, because that's what we've always done.
Yep.
So we've got to unlearn some sort of habituated responses. Yeah. And that's why it's useful, because it's like a reconditioning.
Say, for example, in meditation, if you feel that your legs are painful,
yep.
Would you actually move to stop the pain, or would you just simply contemplate on the pain?
You'd need a little bit of practice to answer that, but the short answer really is, if that's happened to you before and you've gotten up and the pain disappears very quickly, then sit with the pain and investigate it as sensation, not my pain, not even pain, because that's a big thing. Try and uncover the various moving sensations there. However, if you get up and the pain doesn't dissipate, then you either need to correct your sitting posture, or you've got some sort of chronic problem you need to deal with. And that's a signal, and we should pay attention to the signal. At more stable, deeper levels of practice, staying with painful sensation that dissipates fairly quickly afterwards, and it can be intensely painful, can be very useful. But again, it's like the Asubha practice. We want to be very, very cautious about that. That would be more advanced practice. I would say to stay with it maybe a little bit longer than you might, but not in any sense where you're carrying any pain for any time afterwards. There is no point in disabling ourselves in the service of meditation practice. It's pointless. You know, this, the way we do it, is not a samurai practice. Yeah. A question up the back.
Sorry. Hmm? So you previously mentioned like meditation while doing other things. So for example, yep. Showering.
Yep. Yeah, sure.
I was wondering, like, is in Buddhism we consider this right meditation, or really like a form of meditation to sort of like focus your concentration?
It's an aspect of meditation. It's more about attentional focus, really. That's right. And remembering to pay attention. It's an aspect of sati, remembering to pay attention. There's more to it than that. But it's an early training, a useful training. It's one we can carry around with us. We can do it in various places. But it's merely an aspect of the practice. And this is, to go right back to the start, I said meditation sits in a context, and meditation has many different parts. So good meditation might be mindfulness. It might be an absorption meditation to produce pleasant feelings. So there are various aspects of those. Is that speaking to what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just going to finish off. I know we're coming closer to time, so I just want to say a couple of things. There's a nice little formulation that a guy called Shapiro came up with quite some years ago that can really help speak to this particular topic. He talked about three aspects of meditation for the sort of life we imagine we want. The first one is self-regulation, the second one is self-exploration, and the third one is self-transcendence. Self-regulation, self-exploration, self-transcendence. It's a very useful little tripartite formula, really, three-part formula. If we're wanting self-regulation, you know, we're getting anxious all the time, and we'd like to figure out how to be less anxious, then possibly a more contemporary form of mindfulness might give us the sort of life we want. That might be the good meditation for us. We might go to a therapist, we might learn mindfulness that's designed to help with anxiety. Why wouldn't we do that, you know? So that's self-regulation. Now, that also happens within Buddhist practice, but it's never been the major focus of the practice. Self-exploration was the second one. Self-exploration for us in the West is usually much more psychological self-exploration or exploration of our social relationships. That certainly has played a part in Buddhism, but the social relationships particularly, but not so much psychological or emotional investigation. It doesn't feature all that highly, certainly in early Buddhism anyway, and even later Buddhism for that matter as well. It's a part, but it's not wasn't really brought out very frequently as a major focus. So that leaves us with self-transcendence, self-liberation. Now that's conceived of in a few different ways in Buddhism. In Mahayana Buddhism, it's said we're already Buddhas, we just need to stop seeing ourselves in such a dualistic way. In early Buddhism, we want to cultivate certain qualities, like wholesome qualities, that then will lead the way to awakening and liberation. Slightly different approaches, but they're both about self-transcendence. One is one focuses more on transcendence here and now in the world as we are. That's Mahayana. Early Buddhism is much, it tends to focus more or wait more liberation for non-rebirth, not being reborn into the world anymore, because of the level of suffering, potential for suffering anyway. But regardless of whichever focus speaks to you, this is a quality that mostly I haven't seen in contemporary mindfulness. Now, that's not a criticism. Contemporary mindfulness hasn't set itself up to answer those questions, mostly. So then we can't criticise of what doesn't set out to be, not to be anyway. If we're looking for some sort of self-transcendence, whatever that means for you, if that's part of our, I'm putting over there, part of our idea of this good meditation for the sort of life that we want, then we're probably advised to explore a Buddhist practice and understand what Buddhism means by self-transcendence, self-liberation. And it comes back to some of the things we've already talked about as well. So self-regulation, extremely useful as students, there's no doubt about that. Self-exploration, very useful as human beings. Self-liberation speaks to something deeper again, I think. Something very deep about not how I am, but that I am. This thing called me, what is that? How does that work? What's that about? And actually, that's what Buddhism comes down to. What does it mean to be a human person in this human body? To be this body? Self-transcendence, self-liberation. So, coming right back to the question, if we're thinking about what a good meditation is for life, we need to think about the context we're in. So your students, there's a certain context. Then we need to think about what the goal is that we want, perhaps one of those three things we've just talked about. And then we need to be aware of the path that we would tread to work towards that goal. And let's not pretend that Buddhism isn't goal-oriented. Of course Buddhism's goal-oriented. It just has very particular sorts of goals that you don't tend to find in contemporary mindfulnesses. Whichever of the Buddhisms you look at, they tend to be about self-transcendence as they understand it. So, context, where you find yourself, what you want the practice for, and how you go about that. These are sort of the three key things in answering this question this evening, the topic this evening. So, thoughts, disagreements, additions? Stunned silence? Silence is also okay. Okay, so I think we might be finished for the evening, yeah?
Yep.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Thank you very much.